It is 7:32, and we have in live for community forum this morning Randy Baker and Beth Sanders, who are co-producers of the documentary Fear and Favor in the Newsroom. I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
It's good to be here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let me start out by asking if you could tell us what is the basic idea behind Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, and when did you come up with the idea to produce it?
Well, Fear and Favor is an hour-long documentary, and it's a series of case studies of self-censorship in the American press. And the way we got the idea to do it is a prior documentary I had done, which was called Making the News Fit, and that was on press coverage of the war in El Salvador. And we interviewed, or I interviewed, a New York Times reporter whose front page story of the 1982 elections was completely rewritten by New York. And it was rewritten for political ideology. What he wrote didn't fit what New York wanted to portray that was going on in El Salvador. And I thought, well, you know, if this is happening at the New York Times, which they have all this prestigious integrity of their journalistic standards, then what's happening in other news organizations? And that's what we started to look at.
I just want to add, it's an important background, I think. The 1982 elections were sponsored by the United States, and they purportedly showed that El Salvador was a democracy, and so it was appropriate for us to fund the government side in the Civil War. And what the New York Times reporter's story really showed was the death squads were still running all over the country, so the left couldn't participate in the elections. The left was the other side of the Civil War, so the elections weren't really democratic, and his story got rewritten to basically conceal that argument.
All right, and then when you started moving on the project and lining up interviews, were you surprised by what you discovered?
Not really, but what was a challenge was to get reporters to speak frankly about what their experience had been. I mean, basically all the reporters that we got to go on camera, with the exception of probably one, their journalistic career, in all intents and purposes, is over with. If they were on the fast track, they're no longer on the fast track. You know, they are now in smaller papers in areas that are not going to ever, they're not going to make a big dent in their journalistic rise to fame and fortune.
And these were not, you know, second-tier players. I mean, four of them had Pulitzer Prizes. They had Emmy Awards. They had won Polk Awards, which is for broadcast journalists the equivalent of a Pulitzer. So these guys were, you know, pretty well at the top of their game before they got into trouble with their bosses.
And what was the summation of, for those that haven't seen your fine documentary yet, what was the summation of things? Was it across the board that this is happening, that there's this influence?
Well, their things have shifted. It depends on the editorial leadership of a given organization, and sometimes that shift, like Sidney Shambert said, he was free to write in the New York Times in the 60s and 70s. The kinds of stories that he was encouraged to write were questions about what's happening with the have-nots. That became a taboo in the late 80s, and then he resigned after a period of time.
Well, they took away his column after he said unflattering things about the relationship of the New York Times and the local media to big business and to some kind of, a freeway project that the local real estate interests were supporting, and Shambert criticized the media and implicitly the Times as well, and for going along with it, and they took away his column for that.
But all these journalists were true believers. They thought their job was to uncover the information that people needed to have a free discussion about public policy. And the trend, like for Frances Sarah, who was also at the New York Times, she was encouraged to do news that you can use. Stories like how to read your heating bill, trends in lifestyle issues. And that's not at all what she had been trained at, the Columbia Journalism School. I mean, she was the reporter who wanted to do the investigative reporting that really got to the heart of the matter. And that's the kind of stuff that over time she realized that this was not being encouraged. And then she did stories that were basically, they were spiked completely. So, I mean, over time, she got the message quite clearly, and then her career ended. And I think the interesting thing about this documentary is hearing what people said, how they got that message, that you've stepped over a line. And they all, if you ask all these different journalists, well, how did you know when you'd crossed the line? And they were pretty amusing, and they all came up with very similar things. Well, you know, that story's going to be hard. You know, you don't have enough time to do that. Or what else have you got on your plate? You know, they're all the ways that anyone in an institution has to figure out what are the values, what are the important things in that institution. And if you work in an insurance agency, I mean, it's the same kind of, you have to be in tune to what your boss wants if you're going to advance. And what happened for these journalists is that they had to confront an institutional environment that contradicted their journalistic integrity.
And I'd add, it contradicted the official portrait that the institutions painted of themselves. You know, CBS, the New York Times, our major news media, you know, more or less have the implicit motto, without fear or favor, which is where our documentary title comes from. And so what these journalists, you know, found was, well, that explicit statement of policy isn't entirely true. And so I think what we tried to do was show this kind of fuzzy area, which is very powerful in shaping American journalism. It does constrict it into a pro-corporate direction. But on the other hand, it's fuzzy in the sense that it's not true to say that the corporate press never reports unflattering or discrediting information about corporations. That's just false. Everyone knows it's false. You can pick up the paper, and almost every day you'll find some stories like that. I think what exists and what we show is there's really a double standard for news in the U.S. There's one standard of, you know, to use Ben Bagdikian's phrase, who's the one of the journalists we use, a former dean of the Berkeley School of Journalism. There's one standard of drama and documentation for stories that don't include discrediting information on corporations and the corporate elite. Then there's another standard for those that do, and it's higher. It's tougher. And so what happens is reporters learn, generally don't go near these stories unless they cross this higher threshold. The reporters we interviewed were the ones who just used one standard. Is this interesting? Can we prove it? And they found out if you apply the same standard to all stories, then you get in trouble.
So this is the policies that are coming from the editorial boards of these different news organizations. And where is the editorial board getting their coaching from? Is that the big owners of these different organizations?
Well, it's, you know, it's great. Some of the people, yeah, it's from the owners, but it's not coaching. It's several of the journalists we talk to discuss, you know, what's going on? Where does this line come from? And they put it in terms of, you know, these are the people they have lunch with. These are the people they socialize with. You don't want to, you know, be going to the club and your paper's running some terrible discrediting things about other people in the club. That's not appropriate. And so, I mean, it's not appropriate in kind of this social sense of the word. And what happens is the people who are given high editorial positions in papers, you know, generally are members of the club or people who sort of see the world the way the members of the club do. So there's not a punishment going on. I mean, you know, think about it. If you hired Pat Buchanan as your editor, you wouldn't have to be flogging Pat Buchanan to tell him, you know, we don't want a lot of unflattering information about, you know, corporate America. I mean, he's with you. That's how he sees things. And that's how people get hired. And it's, you know, it's not even sinister in the sense that I think the people doing the hiring don't believe they're doing anything wrong. It's sort of natural. You hire people who you think have a good handle on things. And it just so happens that the people who own the media see the world generally the same way, and it's a pro-corporate way.
And I think that's the kind of explanation for why Rush Limbaugh, who had the same kind of ratings as Hightower on their radio shows back in the, I don't know what period of time it was, but, you know, he got, Rush Limbaugh got promoted all over the place, and we know what the result is, whereas Jim Hightower, his show got canceled, even though on the ratings, who they were reaching, how many people in the audience were listening to him, were equivalent in their early part of their career.
Interesting. Well, speaking of careers, how has when did you finish production of Fear and Favor? When did it hit the airwaves? And
well, we were fortunate to finish the show at a PBS station, a renegade PBS station in San Jose, and they gave us editing facilities and an editor to finish it because we couldn't finance the last leg of the production. It was we were wringing blood out of a rock, and the rock came up dry. So it was a long struggle to get it finished. And when we did that editing with the PBS station, they then took it and had the right to market it to the PBS stations across the country. And so it was finished in 1996, and then it took a year of negotiations with PBS to actually feed it through one of its satellite feeds across the country, and it was given free to all the PBS stations. But it was they have like three different satellite feeds, so we were on the bottom of the food chain, the one that doesn't have high promotions or fit within the budgets of a local station. You know, it wasn't the must-buy kind of product, and we had to promote it with station by station and use grassroots organizing to help promote the airing of it on station by station.
But for instance, for local here in Seattle, KCTS 9 would be our PBS affiliate. Would a station like that have to have paid anything to show that?
No, but in terms of, like, it still costs them money to put any kind of a show up. I mean, it didn't cost them out of pocket to buy it. But, you know, they have their budgets, and they have to figure out how they're going to allocate those funds. And PBS, I mean, the station here, they were one of the later ones to broadcast it, but in the meantime, a citizen vagrant, which was an activist group, was harassing them repeatedly. And by the time they actually aired it, they did really well with us. They promoted on an on-air clip. They featured it in their news magazine, and I think it got a decent rating. It also was reviewed in both newspapers and got received very good reviews, which it's pretty remarkable now, reading the newspapers. Very few standalone documentaries get that kind of attention, and I attribute it to the grassroots effort.
So, and were you local residents at the time, or were you?
Yeah, at that point we had lived in the Bay Area, and we moved back to Seattle.
So you think that helped with the little club buildings?
No, I don't think so.
So it doesn't sound like productions like this, not only is it independent, but it obviously, you know, slaps the face of corporate media, do very well, even in a situation like trying to go out through venues like PBS and or other independent venues, which I can't. What other places besides PBS would you put out a documentary like Fear and Favor in the newsroom?
Well, I mean, it's being shown in universities. That it's done very well there. Occasionally, progressive organizations see value to it and use it as a fundraiser or whatever. And, you know, the Society for Professional Journalists has shown it, even though their journalists don't cover it when they attend their own showings. Perhaps they're not allowed to. But public broadcasting in the U.S. is, although it's not owned, public broadcasting, by that I mean PBS and the PBS affiliate stations around the country, although they're not privately owned, they are largely privately funded. And even though individual viewers who might only be paying, you know, $50 or $100 a year or something, give them a lot of money, maybe even a majority of the money. A very important part of their money and their boards come from large corporations. They, as a result, are very hostile to documentaries like ours. Again, it's, you know, the fact is, you know, when the community pushes, they get on. But they have to push. It's not a disinterested process of the producers looking and seeing, is this the kind of thing that will appeal to our audience? Is this the kind of thing that will, you know, raise kind of an interesting or useful discussion in the community? Because, you know, I think even if you disagree with our documentary, and many people do, I think it's pretty hard to deny that the kind of discussion it provokes is useful. It's the kind of discussion that should go on about any large and powerful institution. But unfortunately, as it stands now, public broadcasting in the U.S. is not substantially different than the private media. And in fact, one of the segments in the documentary we show, a couple of them, show PBS doing substantially the same thing as the commercial media. In one case, we have Peter Grauman, who is an award-winning, I believe an Emmy award-winning journalist. He was doing a story on a nuclear waste dump sighting in Southern California. And, you know, the local farmers were against it. I think Native Americans were against it. Environmentalists were against it. And the reason they were is these things always leak.
Well, I think in that case, it was a fallacy to call it a facility because all it was a hole in the ground. And it was a dry hole, and that was the scientific improvement over the selection of a prior site, which was a wet hole. I mean, literally, this is what... And his story actually detailed what was the so-called facility. I mean, it burst the bubble of that technical jargon that really meant absolutely the reverse of what, opposite of what they were intending with this so-called site. And his story was edited to take the guts out of the story, to actually say what was going to be there. And the editor said that he had to shorten the story. So,
but so what got shortened was not just that the facility was a hole in the ground, but also that all the other quote-unquote facilities leaked.
Mm-hmm.
They leaked. And so all you saw was these, you know, guys in suits saying this is, you know, really scientific and good. And then you see a bunch of local people standing with signs and, you know, they look like goofs because why are they, you know, they just must be stupid or uneducated. Why are they doing that?
NIMBYs. Yeah.
And so Grauman in the film says, you know, this is, I realize afterwards, they basically turned my story, which was, you know, trying to show both sides, into a pitch for the government and industry position. And PBS, we briefly show Jonathan Quitney. He was a Polk Award or some kind of award-winning journalist. That, he had been at the Wall Street Journal. He had had something called the Quitney Report on PBS for a while. And he, you know, he did hard-hitting journalism. He showed U.S. involvement in the coup d'etat in Guatemala that terminated democracy there in the 50s and our assistance to basically a death squad operating government through the 80s. His show got cut, and he explained, you know, no corporation wanted to fund me, and PBS wasn't going to put me on unless I had a funder. And, you know, the average folk don't have money to pay for my show.
And I think that goes to the heart of PBS funding when Randy was saying that probably the majority of PBS funding for each individual station does come from listeners. But what that goes is that pays the rent or pays for the hard stuff, the facility stuff, as far as program, the corporations underwrite specific programs. And then that is the funding that becomes very ideological. What's going to advance their interests? They're not going to step forward and finance or corporate underwrite investigative journalists like Quitney. And so Quitney didn't have that funding source, so his show got cut off. And some of my friends said, well, you know, if you wanted to put this on PBS, why did you have two stories within your hour documentary that were critical of PBS, you know? And I don't think it made that much difference in the decision-making of an individual PBS station. What the taboo is that we were talking about corporate influence over self-censorship in the press that follows the corporate interest of the owners of that media outlet.
So it begs the question of what can we do to fix this system that continually seems to get worse as time goes by. Have your hopes been bolstered at all by the recent FCC changes that the Congress actually showed some degree of spine here recently?
It was stunning, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't believe that was our Congress that did that. any thoughts there?
Well, I have positive and negative thoughts. I'm delighted that some significant amount of the public is starting to view media policy and communications policy as important and something that requires citizen input. So that's step one, and that's starting to happen a little, which is great. What discourages me is the focus is on media consolidation, which I think is a bad thing. I mean, I think it's good that people understand that having one or two or three multinational corporations controlling almost all the media in the United States is bad. But it was not good when 50 of them did or 100 of them did. Because when that was the case, our documentary shows the American media largely pre-1996, which was when, under so-called liberal Democrat Bill Clinton, the first deregulation of, at least the first Telecommunications Act by Congress deregulating the mass media began and resulting in the major consolidations of media ownership that have occurred now. But even before then, you still had the same phenomena of corporate elites choosing who would have access to the media. And so if the media reform movement focuses all its attention on, returning things to the status quo ante back to 1995, we would still have a media that doesn't allow us to understand the causes and possible solutions of all kinds of problems, ranging from, why people can't have decent health care in the United States to why it seems we need to invade a third world country every 5 years. So to get to that problem, I think I am concerned that the discussion is not addressing the broader issue of how the public can own mass media and have access to it. And I'm not thinking by that of seizing control of the New York Times from the Sulzberger family or the corporation that owns it.
But that would be fun.
But what I am thinking is following what Justice Brandeis advised 80 years ago as the appropriate response to dangerous or inappropriate or untrue speech, which is more speech. We need to understand that to have democracy in the U.S., just like you can't have a poll tax to vote because it's unconscionable, because you can't have a democracy, we have to have public access, public endowment, an infrastructure for mass media. So, I mean, I've taken a proposal from an economist who happens to be my brother that he used in copyright and suggested we could do this for the mass media. And it's not the only option, but it just gives an idea of what I think we need to do. And that is to give every adult citizen in the U.S., just like on your tax return, you can write off a few dollars for a political party. So there's public financing of the parties. I think every citizen can be given $150 to check off on a ballot or a form at the post office and dedicate that money to the nonprofit media organization of their choice. And if you did that, you would start empowering groups of 100, 1,000, 10,000 people to, have their own websites, their own newsletters, and, once you get up to 10 or 20,000 people doing that, you can have your own broadcast outlets, and you could even have your own paid staff. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to guarantee the public the ability to create or become their own trained journalist, trained media producer, to broaden the discussion in the U.S. so we get to talk about, that is by what I mean we, the majority of the public who aren't in the corporate elite, that we get to decide what we want to hear and speak about.
So you are doing a showing. There's a showing of your film, Fear and Favor, in the newsroom coming tomorrow night.
Yes, at 7:30 at the Independent Media Center, 1415 3rd Avenue. And if folks also want to look at our website, it's www.fearandfavor.org.
Very good. And they can order copies of the film from there?
Yes, and the Seattle Library has copies of the film.
Oh, that's excellent. All right. Well, we still have a couple minutes left, so get some final words in here. So are you hopeful with this, again, with the recent FCC change, if we get people doing things like what Randy suggested, taking back our airwaves? You know, we're looking at, again, with the FCC stuff that, I mean, we had people on both sides. It didn't seem to matter what your political views were, that people are incensed about once they discover that they are our airwaves, that that this has gotten this far, and that, that essentially what you told people in your film is as bad as it is.
Hopeful, yes, hopeful. I think it's fascinating because I don't get why the National Rifle Association jumped on board with this. I'm assuming it's because they had their ads banned from certain outlets. Like, that's happened on the left. When they want to have paid advertising, they have been unable to do so. So I'm only assuming that the National Rifle Association experienced something like that as well. I mean, I don't get it. I know apparently the... it seems like it's a fascinating coalition of very disinterest groups coming together. So what that means in the long term, I just think it's advancing the whole concept that we have to look at media as a public resource. And certainly the airwaves are owned by the public. I mean, that's a shocking concept for some people. And we used to have kind of... stipulations about public affairs. Now, you might not have liked how that was executed, but if we can continue to advance that discourse, saying like candidates should have, every candidate who's running for a major office gets free airtime. I mean, that would just be amazing to have open up the public discourse on stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like the two are natural allies. The people's incensed about the current election system and problems we have there, and then the media as well. It seems like those are two issues that no matter what your political views are, that people are getting riled up about that. So,
well, the one good thing about how this whole trend of market-driven news and bimbo news kind of has happened over the last 10 years is so many more people understand that they're not getting the information they need to be an engaged citizen. I mean, I think that's been a tremendous shift in the last 10 years. And the next question is, well, what can you do with that awareness?
Very good. So it's a direct threat to our democracy. It's becoming clear to a lot of people. So, well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. So thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Just been talking with Randy Baker and Beth Sanders, who are the co-producers of the documentary film Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, which, again, will be airing tomorrow night at the Seattle IMC down there on 1415 3rd Avenue, 7:30 p.m. So, and I believe one of you at least will be there speaking as well afterwards. So thank you both.